Hello, I'm Chuck Weiss, and welcome to Close Encounters. I'll act as your guide while together we explore the twin phenomena of UFOs and alien abduction. I've been personally involved in the alien abduction phenomena for over two decades now, and one of the things I hope to do with these podcasts is to present to a new audience information that I've acquired over the years, some of which has never been reported by any other researcher. An aspect of the abduction phenomena that is both fantastic and far-reaching in its implications is the apparent mixing of human and alien DNA to create hybrid children. Much has already been written about this subject by more capable researchers than me, such as Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, but tonight I'll tell you about the original alien hybrid program that is still in operation in an underground laboratory in New Mexico, and operated not by aliens, but by Nazi scientists at the very core of Majestic. Also, later in the program, I'll reveal the reason that saucer crashed outside Roswell, New Mexico in July of 1947, and it wasn't because of a thunderstorm. Not one, but two exclusives tonight, here on Close Encounters with Chuck Weiss. But first, please listen to this.
What is Cop Watch? Cop Watch is a network of activist organizations in the United States and Canada that observe and document police activity while looking for signs of police misconduct and police brutality. Their database is a permanent searchable repository of complaints filed against police officers at copwatch.org. You can report an incident for permanent inclusion in their database at copwatch.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio in San Francisco.
This is Brett Denon, and you are listening to Mutiny Radio.
That was Starflight by Kevin Brahini. As a point of trivia, the first 20 seconds of that track was heard years ago in movie theaters as the signature theme for the Dolby sound system. In these Close Encounter podcasts, I'll occasionally focus on various aspects of what appears to be an alien agenda here on Earth. Tonight, I'm going to tell you about the human-alien hybrid program. Researcher Bud Hopkins was the first to uncover this part of the alien agenda. Some women abductees were reporting that when they were pregnant, their fetuses suddenly vanished. These were confirmed pregnancies, many of them with ultrasound images. The distraught women were often accused by their doctors of aborting their children, even though there was no physical evidence of any such procedure being performed. I remember one woman who was part of a UFO support group that I attended years ago. She described losing her fetus not once, but several times, and of having her medical records disappear. Her doctor turned against her, refusing to see her again when he had initially been concerned and supportive. Hers was the first such story that I had heard, and it seemed very bizarre to me at the time, but her testimony was so obviously heartfelt and sincere that I was inclined to believe her. Some of the women later reported seeing their half-alien offspring aboard a flying saucer. They appeared to be physically emaciated and lethargic in their movements, with only patches of hair on their heads, if any at all. In each instance, the Greys urged the mothers to hold and comfort their children in an apparent attempt to have them bond with one another. Although some reacted favorably and attempted to do what they could to nurture their young, many others recoiled in disgust at the thought of holding their alien-looking children. The human mothers had been reunited with their hybrid offspring in a last-ditch effort to repair the psychological damage done to them due to their emotional neglect. It seemed that while the Greys provided everything the hybrid children needed to grow physically, they couldn't give them the love they required to develop emotionally. For that, they needed their human mothers. Now, over 20 years later, most researchers agree that Hopkins was right, and that there is an ongoing program in place to create human-alien hybrid children. What they don't know is that program didn't begin in some alien laboratory on another world, but in a secret CIA underground base here on Earth. In August of 2006, I attended a UFO convention in Santa Clara, California. OPUS, the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support, had reserved a room to host a support group meeting for those abductee experiencers in attendance. If you're new to these podcasts, let me tell you that I will sometimes combine the words abductee and experiencer so that I can best address both groups of UFO contactees without denying either the right to describe themselves in whatever way they wish. Abductee is, of course, a negative word implying that the person is a victim, while experiencer is a more neutral term that many contactees prefer to use instead. Chairs for the support group were drawn into a loose circle, and after everyone sat down, they began telling their stories in turn. One attractive middle-aged woman, who I'll call Colette, had a very interesting story indeed. Colette's parents divorced when she was a child, and when she was in her 30s, she visited her father shortly before he died. She didn't know much about him, except that he had been in the Army during World War II, serving in the OSS, Office of Strategic Services. The OSS was the wartime intelligence agency that afterwards morphed into the CIA. He asked her if she knew why she had ongoing experiences with UFOs and aliens since she was a baby. She was surprised at the question because she had never discussed those matters with him. "No, I don't know why," she answered. "You're a hybrid," he told her bluntly. "What do you mean hybrid?" she asked. "You're half human and half alien." He went on to say that she was created as part of a government experiment. At first, Colette thought that he must be talking about both her and her twin sister. "No, it was only her that was the hybrid," he said. "Her sister was an accident." Colette went on to explain that although her twin sister had developed in an embryo sac like all fetuses, she evidently hadn't. Her mother had told her that the doctor couldn't find it. She also said that Colette and her twin sister had been born with entirely different blood types. As I listened to her, I could only imagine what it was like to have such a bizarre conversation with one's father. Her story intrigued me, however, because my father also served in the OSS during the war. I listened intently as she continued her story, and as she did, I realized that Colette looked very familiar to me, although I was sure that we had never met. Colette said that in the aftermath of that disturbing exchange with her father, she began to remember bits and pieces from her past. One memory was of being escorted as a child by men in uniform into an elevator that went down its shaft for, quote, what seemed like forever. She was frightened and started crying. Colette remembered that the men admonished her to stop crying because, quote, it wasn't allowed. Afterwards, when everyone had told their stories and the support group meeting ended, she and I got together to talk. Colette remarked to me that I looked very familiar to her. She even recognized my printed name when I gave her my business card, although she couldn't remember in what context she had seen it. we both felt that we had been brought together for some reason. When the conversation turned to our fathers and their service in the OSS, we discovered that they had something else in common. My father was born in Berlin, Germany, as a Jew. Although her father had been born in this country, his father, her grandfather, was German and Jewish as well. We regarded these coincidences as curious, to say the least, but I decided to defer judgment on her fantastic story, even though she seemed very sincere and credible to me. Sometime later, however, I was able to confirm the basic facts of Colette's story in such a way that it made it very plain why the ETs had brought us together. Most people don't believe in psychics because most people don't personally know any. It's rare that someone can claim to know a real psychic. I happen to know three. Harold, not his real name, has been a dear friend of mine for over 2 decades now. He is extremely sensitive psychically in that he is in close contact with a chorus of invisible grays that guide him in things important and who will sometimes even answer questions when asked. Harold is poorly educated, suffers from fetal alcohol syndrome, and is extremely dyslexic, yet when he channels, he uses 3- and 4-syllable words, a rarity in his vocabulary, and expresses himself so much more easily than he does when he's just himself. Sometime after I returned from the convention where I met Colette, I had Harold over for an evening of conversation with his ETs. I forget what specifically I wanted to learn from Harold's voices that evening, but they had their own topic of conversation in mind. Harold interrupted me to say that he had something he was supposed to tell me and that it was going to be disturbing. The voices, he said, were telling me that I was a hybrid. I replied that I had sometimes wondered if I was one of those hybrids that researchers like Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs had written about. No, not made by the ETs, he said. A hybrid made by the Men in Black. Men in Black is Harold's favorite term for the agents that monitor and harass UFO contactees. I call them Majestic. I was a bit taken back, but finally replied, "Funny you should say that. I met a woman recently who said that she was a government-created alien hybrid." "Of German-Jewish ancestry," he interrupted. Harold hadn't missed a beat, but my heart did when I heard that. I'm normally very skeptical of people claiming to channel unseen entities, but it's little things like that that have convinced me over the years that Harold is the genuine article. Further questions revealed details. The hybrid program was developed by Nazi scientists brought into the United States right after the war through Operation Paperclip. After World War II, hundreds of German intelligence agents, scientists, and industrialists had their records sanitized of their Nazi affiliations under a top-secret black ops program called Operation Paperclip. They were then brought into this country and put to work on our fledgling space program and other important projects in direct violation of President Truman's order that all former Nazis be forever barred from entering the U.S. Those Nazi spies were secretly incorporated into the OSS, which 2 years later morphed into the CIA. I asked Harold's ETs if my father knew I was a hybrid, like Colette's father did. Colette had described her father as a cold and heartless man, someone you could imagine might offer up his family to such an experiment. My father was also a cold fish, but he was very protective of his children, and I just didn't think he would do such a thing. Yes, pause, no, pause, wait. For the first time, Harold's voices weren't speaking as a chorus. He was getting conflicting information. They told him, but they made him forget, was the final answer. Obviously, my father hadn't reacted in the way that Majestic had hoped. It took a while to sink in, but there it was. Something on the other side was telling me that I was part of the same government alien hybrid program that supposedly created Colette. But how did scientists, Nazi or otherwise, pull off something like that in the middle of the 20th century? I'm now 67 years old. Colette is 2 years younger than me. Yet our mothers were supposedly impregnated using in vitro fertilization techniques in the mid to late 1940s. Nazi SS Dr. Joseph Mengele, with his barbaric experiments on identical twins at Auschwitz, was probably the world's leading authority on genetics at the time, but he was nowhere near close to creating human hybrids of any kind, much less hybrids using alien DNA. How was that possible, I asked. The hybrid program was begun with help from the Greys, the voices replied. Each side had their own reason to collaborate on the project. Harold's chorus explained that they thought they were building a bridge between humans and themselves that would help promote understanding and eventual acceptance of open contact between the two species. As for the Nazi scientists, they undoubtedly saw it as an opportunity to create their Aryan Superman. Harold's chorus of Greys said that they supervised the project from an underground laboratory, teaching Majestic scientists the procedures involved and selecting DNA donors from the human bloodlines they've been monitoring for millennia. People of German ancestry were selected at the insistence of the Nazi scientists. The Greys used Jewish bloodlines because they are among humanity's oldest, reaching back over 5,000 years to ancient Mesopotamia. Abraham, patriarch of the Jews, was born in Ur, its ancient capital, and his father was, according to Zechariah Sitchin, a high priest of the Mesopotamian moon god Nanarsin. There was a major falling out between the paperclip scientists and the Greys, which I'll tell you about in the next segment, after which each side continued to develop their own separate alien hybrid program. Later conversations with Harold's chorus of Greys revealed further details about the hybrids. Now, if a hybrid created by the Greys turns out looking like a human baby, it's left with human parents on Earth to grow up. We were told that many also wind up in orphanages. Until recently, if it looked like a Grey, it was raised with the Greys. This proved disastrous, however. Not having any direct experience with emotions and only a clinical understanding of the difference between them, the Greys didn't foresee the need for emotional bonding between parent and child. As a result, they grew up listless and lethargic, emotionally unresponsive. Like humans, the Greys sometimes don't consider unforeseen consequences. Harold's chorus tells us that things are done differently now. The gray-looking hybrid babies are being given to human foster parents who raised them on other planets. They didn't elaborate as to whether the humans left Earth voluntarily or not. At first, I assumed that they went willingly. To me, it made no sense to take someone against their will and then ask them to raise a child that looked like their abductor. The parents would naturally be resentful. And besides, there is no limit to the number of human volunteers who would jump at the chance to live off-world for such a worthy cause. I decided to ask them directly to confirm my reasoning on the subject. I was surprised by their answer. If the humans see the child as human and not as a gray, they didn't finish the sentence, but the implication was clear. Regardless of how the humans leave Earth, willingly or not, they're manipulated into believing that they're raising a human child instead of a gray. When the first generation of gray-looking hybrids matured with the full range of human emotions, there was another unforeseen consequence. With all the attention they were given and the importance they saw placed upon the hybrid program, of which they were the end result, many felt themselves superior to their unemotional cousins. Much like the little emperors of China, children born under that government's one-child-per-family policy, they felt privileged because of all the attention given to them. Now that's all we need, Greys with attitude. The hybrid program of the Greys, though, has resulted in at least one positive result for us humans. The new Grey hybrids are much more sympathetic toward us than the old-school variety. Because they have the same full range of emotions that we do, they can now empathize with us, whereas before they didn't really know what that word meant. Half of Harold's chorus is now made up of the new emotional hybrids, with the other half still comprised of the old unemotional type. Harold and I now find that they are much more forthcoming with answers to our questions than they were before, with half of them more willing to spill the beans, so to speak. In my next podcast, I'll tell you about some other astonishing things that Harold's chorus of Greys has told us. We're going to take a break. When I come back, I'll tell you about Majestic's hybrid program that is still in operation and what really happened on a stormy night in July of 1947. Coming up next, the real story behind the Roswell incident. This is an exclusive. I guarantee you have not heard this before.
It's sad but true, but every 2 minutes, an American is sexually assaulted. Take action today. Join RAIN in the fight against sexual violence and volunteer in your local community. Visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org to find out how you can make a difference and turn the tide against sexual violence in America. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
The House of Pride radio show, LGBT radio for everyone.
Funky interviews, funky beats, talking drag queens, and much, much more. It's LGBT radio for everyone.
Listen live every Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. House of Pride radio, LGBT radio for everyone. Celebrating the considerable contributions of the LGBT community in San Francisco and beyond. Every Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. Listen here for hot new local beats by LGBT artists and listen to live interviews. Tune in. Turn on every Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m., House of Pride Radio with drag queen personalities, ooh, Tweeka Turner and Pearl Tees.
That was Cyberspace by Stephen Halperin, one of the pioneer composers of New Age music. Harold's chorus of voices was particularly talkative that night. They had just told us that when I was born in 1947, I had been a product of genetic engineering as part of the original alien hybrid program conducted by Nazi paperclip scientists under the supervision of the ETs known as the Greys. But they didn't stop there. They went on to talk about the Roswell incident. The military had, quote, borrowed a flying disc, and when the Greys went to retrieve it, the order was given to shoot them down. That was supposedly why a UFO crashed near Roswell, New Mexico, or at least that's what Harold's voices said was the reason. Being a skeptical person by nature, I decided to reserve judgment on that part of their history lesson, but it wasn't too long before I received confirmation from an independent source that it was true. 2 days later, I had lunch with Lila, who has been a good friend of mine for over 30 years, and one of the other two genuine psychics I know. We had lunch together, and she listened to my story about what Harold had told me. Lila knows Harold and respects his chorus, but she has unseen sources of her own. When I came to the part about the underground laboratory, I described it as being abandoned, although Harold hadn't actually said one way or the other. Not abandoned, it's still in operation. She leaned back in her chair and stared up into empty space. It's within a 100-mile radius of Roswell, New Mexico, she said, then paused. No, make that 70 miles. She blinked twice and then looked at me. Funny you should mention Roswell, I said. Harold told me the scientists borrowed a saucer and that when the Greys tried to take it back, they shot them down, and that that was the whole reason behind the Roswell incident. Not borrowed, Lila said. She paused and looked up again for a couple of seconds before continuing. It was more like misappropriated. She later said misappropriated was the word that her voices had used. Lila independently confirmed what Harold's chorus had told us. The Roswell incident was about a technology exchange gone bad. The Greys were willing to give humans their secrets of genetic engineering, but not their flying machines, with their propulsion systems and weaponry. When Majestic took one, they came to take it back. A quick decision was made at that point, and the war between Majestic and the Greys began that stormy night. And it continues to this day. I'll expound on the war between Earth and the flying saucers in a future podcast. I fully expect to receive another round of abuse from Majestic for what I've just told you, but I'm determined to fight them the best way I can, with my blogs at abductedbyaliens.org and my podcasts here at mutinyradio.fm. The information I presented here will most likely get lost in the vast sea that is the Internet and probably won't receive much attention from the UFO community, if any at all, but at least it's out there now and part of the public record. We're going to take another break. When we come back, I'll pick up where I left off, reading from my book, Abducted by Aliens.
Safe sex is more than just avoiding STIs and pregnancy, no matter what you're into. Make sure that you and those around you feel safe, comfortable, and are having a good time. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
And now, coming to the stage, a public service announcement from the Laughter Foundation. Are you funny? Do you exhibit signs of being a comedian? Do you find yourself constantly making a room full of strangers laugh? Do you find yourself stressing out about not knowing where your next comedy gig is coming from? Do you sometimes find yourself depressed for no apparent reason? You may be suffering from being a stand-up comedian. My name is Stephen Allen Green, the founder of the Laughter Foundation. We here at the Laughter Foundation know that with comedy creativity often comes natural side effects such as depression and confusion. I urge anyone who is suffering from depression, especially professional stand-up comedians, to seek out professional help immediately. Therapy literally saved my life. Plus, therapy can help you creatively. Don't suffer silently. Your demons are just hecklers who can be thrown out of the comedy club in your head. Contact your local psychiatric services and don't be ashamed. Get the help that you need and deserve. If you are feeling imminently suicidal, contact the local suicide hotline immediately. And contact us too. We always have new ideas and can connect you to a mental health care professional. Don't feel ashamed. We understand and support you. After all, there is no greater nobility than making the world laugh. And sometimes, that's just a bit too much of a burden. We need and must take care of our own. Thank you for your time and for your services to the comedy community. Find us at thelaughterfoundation.org.
That was Kilimanjaro by the Soto Koto Band. We've come to the part of these podcasts where I read from my book, Abducted by Aliens. If you prefer to read it yourself, it's available free, all 369 pages, as a PDF download at my website, abductedbyaliens.org. In my last podcast, I described how I remembered a dream I had years ago where there was nothing but blackness and the sound of my daughter screaming, and how I tried to wake up but couldn't. I told how the realization that my 9-year-old daughter was also involved in this thing called alien abduction turned the optimism I had about my own ET experiences to vengeful hate whenever I thought about how they terrorized my little Katie, and how my sense of self-righteousness was later deflated when I heard how hundreds of women and children were hacked to death with machetes inside a church in Rwanda. I also described the night when my daughter stayed over and how I fought a losing battle to stay awake to prevent them from taking her. Picking up where I left off on page 49 of Abducted by Aliens, or How I Learned to Cope with High Strangeness, Government Harassment, and My Mother, a True Story, copyright 2008. Tuesday, April 19th, 1994. I laid down to take a nap this afternoon. After a while, I was able to doze off, but I awoke fully alert when I heard the faint but very distant single ring of a telephone. It never sounds like my bedroom phone. The tone is always a little different. I opened my eyes and took note of the time, 4:52 p.m. I immediately became very sleepy. I couldn't keep my eyes open, although I had been wide awake just a few moments before. I barely had but a few seconds with which to note the sudden change in my mental alertness before falling into a deep sleep. I awoke again at 6:13 p.m., feeling very refreshed. I almost hesitate to report this. Although I was tired and needed a nap when I laid down, I was feeling rather sexy and fell asleep snuggling up to my pillows. They felt good against my skin and gave me a warm, sensual feeling, letting me relax into sleep. Later, as I was getting dressed, I noticed that my penis was shrunken and shriveled. I touched myself and found that it was moist and smelled of semen, but I couldn't find any evidence of a wet dream in my bedding. I've heard that men who are abducted are often milked of their sperm or given the chance to mate in the traditional way. If I'm going to make it with someone, however, I'd like to remember the experience. Late evening. In his book Communion, Strieber warns the visited against judging whether the phenomena they're experiencing has existence in reality. For our own sanity, he encourages us to take the position of an agnostic. What? Just forget about it and go about my business? To believe that the phenomena is completely in the mind of the subject, one must come to the position that he or she is in need of professional psychiatric help. I was concerned with exactly that possibility earlier, and it was a very difficult time for me. To believe that these experiences are grounded in physical reality is to start an endless stream of speculation. I already find that I spend most of my time thinking about all the different possibilities that this portends. As a result, I've been all over the map emotionally, ranging from hopeful acceptance to angry defiance. To believe or not to believe, or to ignore what's happening entirely, that is the question. But how does one ignore something like this? I feel like I've opened a Pandora's box, and as much as I might like, I can't put things back the way they were. The demons have already escaped. I'm sorry, Mr. Strieber, but I've gone through too much to pretend that this isn't happening. Wednesday, April 20th. Margaret called to ask me for my mother's phone number because she's mislaid her address book. She's maintained a good relationship with her, even after our separation. I'm happy about that for Catherine's sake. Margaret knows of my ET visits. We had dinner at a loud Mexican restaurant a while ago, and, after I had a couple of beers and she had a couple of margaritas, I mustered the nerve to tell her, and she was relaxed enough to listen. At first, she believed me, even expressing a willingness at the time to undergo hypnosis to see if it would reveal anything. But now she vacillates between thinking me eccentric at best or mentally ill at worst. Her last stated position on the subject was, quote, "I don't want to believe." I can understand her dilemma. If Margaret accepts what is happening, then she must also accept her inability to do anything about it. At this point in our relationship, she doesn't really care that much about me, but when it comes to Catherine's welfare, she's like a lioness protecting her cub. To believe that her daughter is being kidnapped in the middle of the night and to know that she can't prevent it is too much for her to cope with. Denial can be an effective protection device. Our conversation turned to Catherine, the one subject that Margaret and I can agree on. It seems that Catherine had moved back to her room a few nights ago, but now wants to sleep with her mother again. I told Margaret what Catherine had said regarding her sleep problems and how they started up again after she tried sleeping in her own bed. I tried to tell Margaret that, although I had originally urged Catherine to try and move back into her own room, I now thought that we should support her emotionally and let her sleep wherever she wants. Margaret started to protest, saying that she didn't think that Catherine was being abducted. I reassured her that I understood her skepticism, and I wasn't trying to change her mind about that. we never did communicate too well. I was only trying to say that I was no longer concerned about the appropriateness of Catherine sleeping with her mother. At that, Margaret relaxed a bit and told me that it had been Catherine's idea to try and sleep in her room again. They had a little argument about something or other, and that had given Catherine the motivation to try and be independent. It didn't work. Now she's back again, sleeping with her mother, after only a few nights alone in her old bedroom. What has frightened Catherine so much as to send her running back to her mother's bed when she wanted so much to be free and independent of her? Friday, April 22nd. I saw my doctor again today, a follow-up to my annual physical examination of last month. I could see by the look on his face and how it changed that it took him a few seconds to remember my unusual case. I told him I had made an appointment with a hypnotherapist and that I knew I was going to need some kind of help one way or another, depending upon the outcome. If we can't discover anything unusual, then I'm going to need psychiatric help, I told him, and if I'm really being abducted, then I'm going to need some special help coping with that. I think that made him feel better. Let me explain here what I neglected to mention in my diary. I wrote earlier that my doctor had offered to ask his father, who was a diplomat of the American Board of Hypnosis for Internal Medicine, to take me on as a patient in order to explore any suppressed trauma that might explain my symptoms of alien abduction. He refused. He didn't want to be associated with anything having to do with such a controversial subject. Hence, I had to look elsewhere for a hypnotherapist. As he started to wrap up the meeting, I asked my doctor if he had consulted with any of his colleagues about the scar on my genitals. I had asked him to do this a month ago, but he had evidently forgotten. He then wrote a referral for me to a Jewish urologist who has a lot of experience doing circumcisions and should be able to offer a medical opinion as to whether or not my scar could be the result of that particular surgical procedure. When I get the insurance paperwork in the mail, I'll be able to call and make an appointment. I'm a little annoyed, though. I've wasted a whole month because my doctor didn't think to make this referral before. On a humorous note, I was sitting on the edge of my bed, setting the alarm for my clock radio, when I heard a pair of electronic beeps. With heart pounding, I quickly took to my bedside pen and paper to document the incident. It was only after the beeps repeated themselves several times that I was able to track them across the room to my air purifier. It appears it's time to change the filters. Tomorrow will be a full day at the Whole Life Expo, an annual festival of all the weird stuff, with lectures and workshops on such topics as astrology, past lives, crop circles, UFOs, and, of course, alien abduction. I want to try and at least get some address or phone number with which to contact a support group. I expect that any such group will require something to attend their meetings, perhaps a referral from a licensed therapist in order to separate the people who really need such support from those who fantasize that they do. At least I'll have the information in hand when I'm ready to apply. As an aside, let me say here that UFO support groups don't ask for proof of anything. I just didn't know that at the time. Saturday, April 23rd. I spent the day and evening with Lila at this year's Whole Life Expo. Of course, I was mainly interested in whatever was being offered in the way of lectures or workshops on alien abduction or close encounters of the fourth kind, CE4, as those who take a more neutral view call it. There were two related events scheduled, a lecture by Edith Fiore and a screening of the movie Fire in the Sky, hosted by Travis Walton, the real-life abductee upon whose experience the movie was based. In addition to the lecture, Dr. Edith Fiore hosted a workshop on her real specialty, past lives. The lecture on abductions was free with the price of admission, but the workshop on past lives cost an additional $15. If attendance is any indication, I bet she'll rethink her strategy on that one. Even as her CE4 lecture was ending, there was a steady stream of people still filing into the room. Dr. Fiore listed 10 typical indicators of the CE4 phenomena. They are as follows. 1. A missing time episode. The person remembers an incident where there was an apparent jump in time. 2. Night terrors. The person might wake up in a sweat at night or have nightmares about UFOs or aliens. 3. Sleep disorders such as chronic insomnia. The person might not be able to sleep but a couple of hours at a time during the night, but can usually sleep normally during the day. 4. Waking up to a tingling or burning feeling, paralysis, or a feeling of pressure. 5. Unexplained physical marks on the body, such as bruises, scars, scabs, or scrape marks. 6. Memories of seeing a UFO. 7. Fear or anxiety of UFOs or extraterrestrials. 8. Memories of a close encounter with something strange or unusual. 9. Unexplained or spontaneous healings. 10. Feelings of being watched or monitored, or that there was some kind of communication with something unknown. Also found associated with this experience are 1. A personal sense of mission, or a change in the consciousness or personality of those abducted, and 2. Heightened psychic ability after contact. Of the 10 indicators listed above, I personally exhibit 9 of them. Here is my list as it corresponds to Dr. Fiore's numbers, omitting only number 6, memory of an actual sighting. 1. I've documented 2 possible missing time episodes in this journal, entries dated April 4th and April 6th. The first was of a memory of something happening in Oklahoma at my grandparents' home when I was a young boy. But there was an apparent jump in time from when I was trying to look out the front window onto the driveway to suddenly being in another room of the house. The second, much more recent, was when 3 hours passed that seemed like just half an hour at most. 2. I've described waking up in a panic, specifically on the night of February 28th, although there have been several other such incidences since mid-January. 3. As for sleep disorders, I'm taking Halcyon, a prescription sleep medication, to help with my nighttime insomnia, and I haven't been able to sleep for more than 2 or 3 hours in a row since all this began. 4. Although I don't remember waking up to any unusual physical sensations, I described feeling pressure against my lower back while sitting on the couch after my exercise injury, journal entry of February 21st. 5. I've documented 2 parallel scab lines at the base of my neck that came and went at least 3 times that I can remember, along with a long scrape mark on my left shoulder, journaled entries of February 18th and March 22nd. And then, of course, there's the scar on my penis. 7. In the beginning, when I first became aware of all of this, there were times when I woke up with my heart racing. This was always accompanied by feelings of great anxiety. These nighttime anxiety attacks, I believe, came right after an ET visit and have been well documented in this journal. And then there's the general sense of anxiety that I often feel, a nameless dread that comes over me and follows me throughout the day. 8. I vaguely remember a close encounter of some sort at my grandparents' house in Oklahoma when I was a young boy. 9. I experienced a spontaneous healing on the evening of February 21st, which I documented at the time. 10. I described how I must have been monitored that night for the healing to have taken place so quickly. Also, on the night of April 16th, while Catherine lay sleeping, I definitely felt that I was being watched as I fought to stay awake. And then there are the 2 bonus points. 1. Arian, a friend of mine, made the remark one night that I don't seem to be as judgmental as I used to be. I think she's right. I'm much more tolerant of people's mistakes. I feel like, who am I to judge? Also, although I feel I have always had a healthy respect for animal life, now I could almost qualify as a Tibetan monk. There are spiders weaving their webs in the stairway leading to the basement and in the corners of some of the rooms. Whereas before I wouldn't have thought twice about cleaning them out, now I just can't bring myself to do it. Live and let live. I just started to cry as I wrote this. My feelings are so close to the surface. And life, any life, seems so precious to me now. And 2. I noticed today as I walked through the crowd at the Whole Life Expo that I was very altered. I had a heightened sense of psychic perception all day. I saw a woman who made me do a double take because she literally radiated a white light. It was like looking directly into a light bulb. I had to stop myself from staring, I was so surprised. As I walked through the exhibits, I would feel the difference in the energy levels that they generated. It was particularly noticeable when I walked past an exhibit of crystals. Wham! It was as if I was hit physically. The blast was so powerful. I've never been receptive to these kinds of invisible energies before, but today I was acutely aware of them. 11 out of a possible score of 12. I believe I deserve at least an A- on Dr. Fiore's CE4 test. We're going to stop there and take one more break. When we come back, I'll tell you about next week's podcast.
Research and practice show that one simple activity, reading out loud, is the best way to prepare young children for learning to read and keep reading as they learn and grow. Reading aloud helps your children develop the language skills that they will use in school and throughout their lives. Reading aloud also creates a special time for you to bond with your children, cuddle together and share your adventures, laugh at silly characters, root for heroes and wag your finger at villains, and do it together. At the same time, you'll be helping your child develop a lifelong appreciation for reading. For more information, go to www.riff.org. That's RIFF.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
This is Eddie Winters, and you're listening to Mutiny Radio, the same great station with a great new name.
Wow, cool.
What's cool?
The new name? What? I thought the radio's talking to me. That's weird.
What was weird?
This. I'm talking to a podcast. That's impossible.
Not really. This is Mutiny Radio. If you're listening, we're listening to...
Cool.
Mutiny Radio, the evolution... has begun.
Thank you.
That number is titled Simple Song, composed and performed by Suzanne Chiani. Close Encounters is produced at Mutiny Radio, located at 21st Street and Florida in San Francisco. Besides hosting a wide variety of podcasts each week, Mutiny Radio serves the community as a venue for a host of entertainment and educational programs. Check out our website at mutinyradio.fm. There is no registration process, and you get free access to dozens of weekly podcasts. There's plenty of music from around the world, political talk, both domestic and global, and I hear even one about UFOs. Mutiny Radio also has a 40-seat performance space available for rent. So if you're a performer looking for a really cheap place to put on a show, contact our station director, Pam Benjamin, at Pam Desai, that's PAMSEDAI, all one word, at hotmail.com. That about wraps it up for this edition of Close Encounters. If you'd like to comment about what you've heard, you can contact me through my website at abductedbyaliens.org. The next time we meet, I'll tell you more about what Harold and I learned from his chorus of gray aliens. Until then, look to the skies.